It is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. Of course, David joins us every Friday. He's a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. He has his own website, themediabeat.us, and you'll also find him appearing on the Huffington Post. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. It's good to be with you, reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City. We're a lot warmer than you are. Today, we're mid-April now, and today's temperatures in the city are going to be 75 degrees.
Well, we're going to get to 70, so there.
Oh, you are?
And we don't have all that traffic.
Right. Plus, we don't have that
freaky
internal...
Freaky times all over, then. Freaky times everywhere.
No. We've always... I actually keep track of this, and you can be good for a good... A couple of 70-degree days, 75. It's just wonderful.
In the middle of April?
Absolutely.
Right. Well, I guess it's just such a shock because it's been such a...
Foul
winter.
Rotten.
Yes.
So I'm so glad you're here, and I'm thrilled to bits with your topic. But just before we get to this topic...
See, he's not that thrilled, David.
No, this is why I'm thrilled to bits with the topic, all right? On a cable station...
The mystery topic. Okay, we'll keep it... We'll hold it in suspense.
Mystery topic, okay. Sign in, please.
I was just going to say mystery guest.
We'll do a Trump on this. We'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens. By the way, one of the smartest things I ever learned, and I don't want to say anything positive, but that was from a man named Giles Hemmings. And Giles was sitting in a meeting.
I'm sorry, I disregard anything I hear from Giles. Come on.
Mistake.
Okay.
Because he said to a person who was very well-regarded and rather difficult, he said, he was asked a question, and he said, person's name, I don't know the answer to your question. And it completely, I mean, obviously he was going to find out, but it completely changed the tenor of the dialogue because he wasn't off and running just in blather. And this is the point, because the blather quotient has now become, it's off the charts. And there were two things that happened this morning. Usually I've had an opportunity to sample a little bit, just a teens of media, sadly. And the first was on the way that stories are being put together. This was on Morning Edition. It's like if you don't have any information, you're not going to find out anything. You just, like, if you don't have the bits right, it's hard to know where to put them. And then layered onto that, I heard on a fairly reputable cable news channel talking about a thought bubble. We'll take your word on your thought bubble. Great. This is a news show.
Well, yes. We'll accept what you have to say as a thought. Sure. Well, there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, but you don't regard it as, you don't regard taking it as an imprimatur for, yes, this should be broadcast. I think this week has shown a very, illustrative lesson in simply those three magic words, which are so important in journalism, and the instance that you quote of silencing troublesome discussion by simply saying don't know the answer is emblematic. I mean, it's the three words that I really value in journalism is I don't know, or we don't know. And that's been at the heart of one it's become very controversial, or at least it's become much talked about, a decision which the Associated Press made last year. They had a story from and concerning, that was the point, its main source was its own subject, so that was problematic to begin with. But the former doorman of Donald J. Trump in New York City, had a story which he claimed was to do with Trump having fathered a child out of wedlock with one of his household staff. And the Associated Press researched that story very thoroughly and decided not to print it. Well, now, not to publish it. And now, of course, it has been published. And it's been published because it's become a different kind of a story. And the we don't know part of it is not so important anymore. It was not possible when the Associated Press was investigating that story last year, and many other media outlets too. And that's become clear in this last week. And in fact, in the media hothouse of New York, it's been sort of off the record, a well-known quote unquote rumor in the journalistic fraternity. I can attest to that. But nobody had any hard evidence sufficient to make it justifiable to publish it. So many other journalists, as well as the AP, took the same decision last year not to publish this story because it couldn't be substantiated substantially. Well, the Associated Press feels different about it now. And one of the things that has changed in the whole landscape is the fact that it's not so much the story of the accusation anymore, it's the story of Donald Trump's friends at American Media, the publisher of the National Enquirer, that well-known bastion of journalistic excellence, paid the doorman $30,000, I believe, for the story and did not print it. Does that sound familiar? Yes, that's American media's general tactic, or well-used tactic, of catch and kill, as it's known in the trade. Pay someone for a story and then sit on it.
A way of
getting silence.
You know what?
So the we don't know changes over time, is what I'm saying.
What the interesting thing about that is someone actually said to me yesterday, oh, come on, what's $30,000 to it? I mean, $30,000, a doorman would want a lot more. And I said, I don't think you realize what doormen what doormen make and how important they are in all these buildings.
But also, they do
quite well.
$30,000 was enough to make it work for a time.
Yeah, yeah.
But just for a time, I would think that'd be good for a couple of weeks.
Because they get paid very, very well. And
well,
tips.
Almost
and tips.
A year in this case, but...
But what I want to talk about is, and again, the rumor, look.
How much money do you think is out there he spent on covering things up over the years?
It doesn't matter.
My God. But it's an economy on its own.
Except, it's an industry.
I hate to make fun of it. I'll shut
no,
up
no,
now.
It has been an industry. We're well aware of that. There is lots of well attested evidence for that.
And the only thing that I would throw into that is there is an industry there, and it's not just an industry of one.
No, of course not. It requires many people and a fair amount of swilling cash.
And there are other people who have,
a certain amount of tamping down of stories that are otherwise going to be troublesome.
Yeah, and because I spend a lot more time on what isn't out there than what is. So this is just a weirdness of me. You know, I'm just weird. I see what isn't. I see dead people. I see what isn't rather than what's being put out there. So there's a much more layered and dynamic. There's much more dimension to what's not seen. And so you sort of get these bits of what's allowed to come out. And then you've got many, many people who are from a national level to a local level who are complicit in putting out their version of events. And you can't look too closely at that, because otherwise you would absolutely have to question the entire you'd have to question the entire industry.
Well, sure, and that's why the whole notion of establishing trust is so important, and maintaining trust and ensuring that what trust you establish as a communicator is maintained and indeed earned every day. That's the point about trusted sources. They've got to keep on doing it and doing it right. And the moment they go wrong in any way, it's extremely dangerous for their credibility and in the ultimate sense for their survivability too.
And the question becomes, you know, if once you've blown up the trust, which has pretty much happened, and you know, the sort of covered up. Well,
Let's not get too hyperbolic about it. I mean,
but I was going to go.
Much of the media is still very trustworthy. Let's.
I was going to go to the Denver Post, because that was an interesting thing that happened this week that got sort of blotted out by other things, and Trunk, one of my favorites.
That's such a great name for a media organization. I was a columnist in one of the publications once when they had a much more simple and straightforward name, Tribune.
Yeah, Trump.
And it's so strange to see them operate with this name, which I presume the name change is intended to create a notion of modernity. What do you think?
I just thought that I just thought they paid a lot of money to some really bad consultants, is what I thought.
Absolutely. Here's a great idea. Here's your new name.
Right. And I just
it's a real zinger. It's Trunk.
That's the bit that always gets me.
I wish I'd been in that office that day.
As do I. You know, just as I wish I'd been in the office the day that somebody said, hey, look, let's just take all the information there is and put it in one place because it'll be safe there.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Right. Got it. You know, doesn't anybody? What did the parents sleep through that beat? I speaking of things that you don't see, I am constantly mystified and entertained at some of these notions that are, shall we say, implemented, executed, and then people, what did you think was going to happen?
The Department of Unintended Consequences is a very large department of journalism.
Yeah. But for those who don't know, the Denver Post was attempting, at least, I have no idea what came of it, to take on their hedge fund ownership and just get a couple more reporters. It's just something, anything, because the other. Once you move out of the media capital of the world and the echo chamber, and you get down to, and we're slightly out of it here. It's very funny because we obviously sample from it, but there really is a necessity for understanding, at the very least, what the local situation is, and local doesn't count as regional. It's you know, local's local.
Sure, absolutely. Different layers of journalism, different priorities. But big regional newspapers with very large corporate owners, that tension is becoming stronger and stronger these days between the independence of the journalistic side and the requirements as the ownership see them. Always going to be a tension between owners and journalists, and understandably so. We live in a capitalist economy, after all.
Someone has to pay for it.
Newspapers have to. Exactly. Somebody has to pay for this.
And you've got to get the advertising back in there, and that's what's really interesting because, you know, through all of this, free publications, for example, I'm thinking the Shopper's Guide, with coupons, etc. And services have continued, and they have continued because guess what? You know, once again, they didn't ask me at the meeting where everyone said, okay, we'll just give this away for free, and then you know that'll be fine. Because once you give something away for free, sadly, on this planet at least, possibly in this solar system, people are dodgy. They don't exactly want to pay for it.
It's probably true. As I say, there are different business models besides the advertising one, selling advertising to sustain a publication. But it's probably true that in general, you get what you pay for. And if you don't pay anything, the chances are you're not going to get much of value. That's a cynical and capitalist-based notion, but I think it's, as I say, generally speaking, true, although you know, there are other models that can be pursued, and when they are, they can be very useful too. Subscription, for instance, you get what you pay for there, very definitely.
Right, but you also have to have taken a view. This is where it gets tricky, because In subscribing and paying, you're selecting something that you like. And this is where we sort of moved off the, not everything's likable.
Hey, you're forgetting one
thing. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
You guys are forgetting one thing. I think in today's society,
this is your thought bubble.
People have really been unfortunately, unintentionally trained not to read. And when I say not to read, I mean not to read newspapers and things that you hold in your hand. If the younger generation, and I'm talking about the millennials over the years, were forced to sit and read the papers, they would be used to buying a newspaper, and they'd buy a subscription to a newspaper online. But unfortunately, over the years, more and more people have dropped reading real books and real newspapers and real magazines, and just gone to the free stuff they find on the internet. And as you say, David, the free stuff they find on the internet is dribble, basically. I'm sorry. It's targeted to the people that go to it. It's biased. 99% of it is biased. And it's not like reading a real newspaper. It's not like reading the Washington Post or the New York Times. When I was younger, even in radio, we depended on the morning papers. They had to be at the radio station. We had to know what was going on. And my parents always had newspaper delivery. It's not the same anymore, and it's hard. You can transfer somebody over from reading newspapers to the internet and paying, but you can't get most of the people who get their dribble for free from outlets that they think like, and then to have them pay for it. It's amazing.
Well, I would say, Marshall, that your thought bubble has heft.
Yes.
The whole idea of being something substantial you can get a hold of is quite a, it works as a conditioning factor for whether you think there's something of value there. The whole idea of intellectual property, what a concept, intellectual property, is somewhat vaporous, isn't it? You mean I've got to pay for something, which to me, as I look at it and the fact that I can't touch it and feel it, suggests to me that it's not very different from the stuff that my friends post on the screen that's in front of me. It's all the same, really. It's pretty much, it's certainly treated the same when it's in your fist and you're just stabbing at a few key icons or keys on your touch screen. It all feels the same. And of course, we know, and when it was in the shape of printed newspaper that was diligently put together overnight previously and then printed lugubriously through metal presses, we know that it's actually very substantial and chunky and meaty, and the substance here that we are being asked to pay for. But it's hard to believe that if you're conditioned entirely by the electronic free flow.
What might happen, and the only thing that really could actually change that, even though there are some newspapers because of the administration that are coming back and are stronger, is that sooner or later, outlets like Facebook and Twitter will not be able to depend on the advertising that they get, and they'll have to start charging. And when that happens, people will drop off of that. And if they want to get their information, they'll have to go to a different model.
They'll actually be forced to do it, and
they'll be forced to pay for it, and that will change the battlefield and the platform for the established newspapers going up against all these social media sites.
But while that's happening, it's going to be a tough retraining. But I suspect from what I am seeing, this is personal, but I think it's beginning to happen because what has occurred is that there are a lot of let's call them kids, just because I'm ancient at this point, who are woefully unprepared for what they need to do. And so they are being, let's just say, retrained, or basically put through critical thinking, communicating skills, basic, when they go to work now. just because they have to.
They're suddenly encountering the real world, yeah. real facts to be checked out and so on. Yeah. Well, yeah. That's probably true. But there's also a way of making that a focused and very intentional process and retraining. I think it is certainly a time, and we talk about this pretty well every week, don't we? It's a question of getting proper media literacy training into people's lives at as early a stage as practicable. One thing I did want to talk about, and that's why I held it out as a subject worth tackling today, and not to keep people in suspense any longer, it's the idea of a Bill of Rights for news consumers. And here's the opportunity. Training of young people on the basis of something like the fact that we could have, or we could certainly operate, a news consumer's Bill of Rights has come up, and I'm glad to say that it's gaining ground amongst schools, not school educators as institutions, but many individual teachers, and in many schools are taking up this as a teaching resource. Mainly led, I'm happy to say, by the Teaching Tolerance Program. I don't know if you know about it, but it's an offshoot of the Southern Law Poverty Center in Montgomery, Alabama, and operating in many southern states too. It has a long, very honorable history of teaching tolerance and attacking intolerance. They're a wonderful, factually based research center, and been very helpful to journalists like me who have been keen to watch over developments like, well, they've helped me in particular with tracking the Ku Klux Klan historically and in the present day, and also neo-Nazi groups too. They are very, 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 very fact-based, reality-based institutions. So their teaching offshoot is valuable, and the teaching resources that they come up with, lesson guides, syllabuses, and the rest, and along with publications like posters and small textbooks, videos, and the rest are all being used by teachers. But one particular resource that they can focus on now, and they and many other people who are taking up this cause are focusing on it, and it's come from PEN America. That's the venerable, I would say, Writers Association. I used to think it was a set of initials and wondered what it stood for, PEN, but it is just the pen of a writer. And they have elaborated now this News Consumers Bill of Rights and Responsibilities. They say that we're all entitled to certain rights, inalienable rights, as news consumers. And it's a very good approach. I recommend it. Go to the PEN site and take a look at this new Bill of Rights, published now for 6 months, and as I say, gaining ground in educational circles, I'm glad to say. And it's a good basis for getting people used early in their lives to understanding what they're entitled to in terms of information, and what indeed their own responsibilities are in terms of doing what you were just talking about, doing the critical questioning of what's coming their way in terms of information. So as well as rights, we have responsibilities as individual citizens consuming news.
Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.